You mentioned the issue of someone who responds, then starts progressing, but is still kind of better than baseline. Is it your general practice to keep the ruxolitinib going until they sort of go past the baseline?
Yeah, so we have a problem in clinical practice that we don't really have very good guidance about what constitutes loss of response or progression on ruxolitinib. I think loss of response is probably the more tricky one. So for my patients, I try to individualize a target that I'm trying to attain with therapy. For this woman, I want to improve your weight loss. I want to give you back your energy. Yes, I might want to shrink your spleen, but for patients who've got a massive spleen that's very symptomatic, I want to improve your quality of life related to your spleen. So get rid of early satiety. If a patient, say, started with a 20-centimetre palpable spleen, it goes to 10, and then gradually over time it's increasing, it's 11 or 12, do I think that constitutes treatment failure? I don't think so. They're still below where they were at baseline. They're not at their maximum response. If, on the other hand, they started at 20, they went down to 15, but now they're at 23, I think that's different. But you have to look at other aspects of response as well. So if that patient, for example, was someone who had intractable pruritus and couldn't bath or shower, like one of my other patients that I started early on ruxolitinib, and they still have a great response in terms of their symptoms, do I take them off the drug? No, I most definitely do not.
Other than clinical trial as an option, are there any non-clinical trial options that you consider in patients progressing on ruxolitinib?
So it depends in what way they're progressing. So if they're progressing because of spleen increase, I have to think about, well, is this something that's worrying me and is it bothering the patient? If it's bothering the patient, I might try adding in an agent that might benefit in addition to ruxolitinib. So I'm thinking, for example, of hydroxyurea or another agent. In a couple of patients, we've used splenic irradiation in addition to ruxolitinib. And I know others, although we haven't done it so much, might resort, for example, to splenectomy in a patient who's much fitter still on ruxolitinib than they were before. There are other things, though, that, you know, more commonly the problem is anemia or thrombocytopenia for these patients. So you want to be able to maintain a dose that gives you what you want for spleen or symptoms, but your patient's needing a transfusion or your patient's sagging their platelet count. And so I think there are a few options there, and we're kind of back to the things that we were thinking about and using in the last, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. So if it's a patient who has borderline renal impairment, for example, I might try an erythropoietin-like agent. Important to remember that on ruxolitinib, you get an increase in EPO levels. And before, we were using EPO levels to have an idea about whether a patient was going to respond to EPO therapy. But you can't do that in a patient on ruxolitinib because usually their EPO level's high. I might use, for example, an anabolic steroid. The one we use in my practice is danazol. That's quite helpful sometimes for anemia and thrombocytopenia. And I haven't used it often, but I've certainly heard from colleagues, and I just started a patient today, actually, on thalidomide. So again, trying to target anemia and thrombocytopenia in a patient, being able to keep them on an effective dose of ruxolitinib, but try to keep the platelet count acceptable. There are patients who progress in other ways, though, of course. They may get leukocytosis, and then you have to decide at what level are you going to worry about the leukocytosis for the patient. So, you know, sometimes patients can have a leukocyte count of 50, 60 or 70,000 before you might be really concerned. On the other hand, if a patient's getting an increase in circulating blasts, then you have to think, well, this is a patient that's progressing towards leukemia, and what's my treatment intent for that patient?
In your mind, I mean, you look at this lady stable now for 4 years. Do you believe that this is a purely symptomatic palliative therapy, specifically ruxolitinib, or do you think it's actually, you know, affecting the underlying, you know, progression of the disease? I know there's a lot of debate about it. What's your current thought?
So that's really interesting. So one of my colleagues refers to ruxolitinib as that expensive paracetamol, which is really irritating because I think the drug is far more than that. I think there are one or two patients, this lady probably, and there are patients that have been reported in the literature. For example, our group reported in Hematologica a few years back, One of my patients on the Comfort 2 study who had a really striking response. So we had to do bone marrows on the Comfort 2 study. We review our bone marrows in a weekly meeting. We sit down with the pathologist and he went, well, this patient's, you know, they've no longer got reticulin fibrosis in their marrow. Their megakaryocyte morphology is approaching normal. And I really sat up and went, really? This patient with myelofibrosis, this elderly man in his early 80s on this drug? And we had a look at him and we actually looked then in more detail. We looked at his JAK allele burden. His spleen was almost non-palpable. His bone marrow morphology had normalized gradually. And it took to about, I think it was about 168 weeks on therapy. And this man actually is still really well. He was one of our first patients in 2009 that we gave the drug to. So there are one or two patients reported in the literature, probably this woman as well. You know, we haven't been looking at her bone marrow because we weren't expecting to see anything and we wouldn't act on it. And it's a painful test. But, you know, I think there are some patients, maybe these are the patients whose disease is, you know, less genetically complex. They don't have these other mutations. And I'm minded of the data from Verstovsek recently showing that patients who have these so-called additional non-driver mutations, so thinking about ASXL1, EZH2, IDH1 and 2, SRSF2. So what he showed was that if your patient has one or more of those mutations in addition to a driver mutation, then their time to treatment failure on ruxolitinib was quicker. So maybe the biological feature, on the other hand, completely the flip side, these patients who have a spectacularly good response, maybe they are the patients who don't have so much genetic complexity. I can tell you about this elderly man who had this amazing response with the bone marrow response was he did have a chromosomal abnormality affecting chromosome 1, which was still detectable. So I think we have still a lot to learn about ruxolitinib. So in my mind, this is a game-altering drug for myelofibrosis. It's not a game-altering drug in the same way as BCR-ABL kinase inhibitors are, but it vastly improves patients' quality of life. My firm belief is these patients live longer on the whole. And for some patients, like this lady and like the man that I mentioned before, they have a spectacular response.